Hi, I'm Heather Mulder.
And I'm Janice Greeno, and you're listening to Dementia Untangled, where we explore the topic of dementia through conversations with physicians, experts, and community leaders.
Our discussions focus on innovative ideas, practical strategies, and proven methods to guide caregivers along a supportive path.
Hello, and welcome to Dementia Untangled. Thank you for joining us for this episode of our podcast.
Today, our conversation will be with Dr. Parichita Chowdhury, a cognitive neurologist at Banner Sun Health Research Institute, and we will be discussing the new treatments that are available for Alzheimer's and related dementias. This conversation really came about as part of almost an off-the-record discussion. Dr. Chowdhury's name is probably familiar if you've been listening to Dementia Untangled. We had a conversation just last season with her. And after we wrapped with recording, we had a really interesting discussion with her that we just thought we have to bring this to our listeners. For those of you who have been around Alzheimer's disease, it probably really stands out in your memory recently. The approval of two new medications for the treatment of Alzheimer's disease, aducanumab and lecanemab. And I recall distinctly when aducanumab was approved because this was a long time coming. Prior to that, it had been 18 years before a new medication was approved for the treatment of Alzheimer's disease. There was such energy and excitement around the approval of both of these new medications. But once we get through that approval process and the advocacy and the energy around clinical trials having positive results, and then advocacy around moving it through the FDA approval process, oftentimes people then are left wondering, what's next? How can I get this medication for my person? So I'm really excited that we get to talk to Dr. Chowdhury again today to learn more about what is next.
Heather, I'm so excited. And I'm thinking back to that episode with Dr. Chowdhury, and it was titled, What You Don't Know About Getting a Dementia Diagnosis. And it was so packed with great information, and her passion to help people living with dementia and caregivers is so evident. And to our listeners, if you haven't gotten to listen to that episode, I highly recommend it. And she shares about the importance of early diagnosis and holistic care and getting treatment early, making decisions early, and setting up support systems early, all to keep the person living with dementia better longer. And she even shared a little about major breakthroughs in the last 10 years. And that conversation after the conversation was also so inspiring. And we're excited to have her back to share more about her incredible knowledge with all of you today.
Welcome back, Dr. Chowdhury. Thank you for joining our conversation again.
Glad to be back, you guys. It was really fun last time.
Last time, we learned a little bit about your journey, and Janice mentioned your passion around your career in cognitive neurology. I'm really curious to learn what triggered you to pursue this passion, to pursue this career.
Yeah, so if you recall, you know, I went on this 1 month elective time during my neurology residency to San Francisco. And I spent some time at the UCSF Memory and Aging Center, where their model of care is very similar to ours, where they spend time with their patients getting to know them. And without giving too much away, I saw this patient being evaluated who had had a very new marriage with his wife of 3 years. And this was his sixth or seventh marriage. And I probably would have never thought much about this fact about anyone in the past. But I recall the neurologist that I was spending time with sitting down and just really asking this person about their life. Just when was the first time you got married? How many children? And it was just a very interesting conversation that finally led to the diagnosis of frontotemporal dementia. And to me, that was fascinating to be able to draw conclusions about brain function and behavior based on our day-to-day conversation and observations. And this is what I love about cognitive neurology and neurology in general. It's a lot of conversations and physical examination and, you know, little tests that don't necessarily depend on big expensive tests. I mean, we have those tools, but they don't depend on it. And that's what I find extremely fascinating about what we do.
Thank you for sharing that story. I think we can all reflect back and think of those individuals who just really made a difference as we got to know them in helping us choose our career or stay in our career, pursue our passion, if you will. So I mentioned in the introduction, we have these two new medications, aducanumab and lecanemab. Tell us what's so exciting about these newly approved medications.
Yeah, so this, something that you have already mentioned is that we haven't had a drug approved in the world of Alzheimer's disease for about two decades. And so the first breakthrough after all these years is really, really exciting. The second reason this isn't exciting is because it is a different type of medication than ones that already exist. So they mechanistically work differently and have potential for what we call disease modification, meaning that they are attacking an underlying disease pathophysiology, which is different than just treating people symptomatically. Now, both of those things are important, but having something that is trying to modify the disease is extremely, extremely exciting because that means that we could build upon those successes in the future.
Well, this is so exciting. And I just remember, like the both of you, I just wanted to stand up and cheer when I heard this news. And our listeners might have noticed that both of these newly approved drugs end with MAB. Can you tell us what are MABs?
So MABs stand for monoclonal antibodies. This is a type of medication that is not new to medicine. They have existed in medicine for many, many years and utilize an ability of our bodies, not just human bodies, but mammalian bodies, to generate antibodies towards a certain target. So if you think about how we respond to viruses or foreign things in our body, we usually generate an antibody response without going too much into immunology, but we generate an antibody response, then our body replicates that response over and over again. So for lack of a better term, we clone that antibody over and over again. And that's why it's called monoclonal antibodies. Now, people may be familiar with these MABs in other aspects of medicine. For example, cancer therapy, melanoma drugs such as pembrolizumab is one well-known drug, and several other MABs. Also in autoimmune world, rituximab is a big one. Multiple sclerosis in the world of neurology has many MABs like this. So the technology and the type of medication is not new, but it's new for Alzheimer's disease. So in this case, our MABs are against the amyloid, which is the protein that we think starts off a cascade of events in the complex pathophysiology of Alzheimer's disease. So these particular MABs, aducanumab, lecanemab and some other drugs that have been trialed and failed, crenezumab, solanezumab, gantenerumab. All of these mAbs target amyloids and are anti-amyloid monoclonal antibodies.
Thank you for breaking that down in such an understandable way. I think mAbs are familiar to myself and likely to our listeners as well, but I never really had a clear understanding of what monoclonal antibodies were and what they did, how they worked. Now, there's so much energy around the approval of these medications. You see organizations like the Alzheimer's Association really activating their advocates to lobby their legislators to reach out to the FDA. We see news stories when we're anticipating positive results from a clinical trial. But once we get beyond that FDA approval, the news stories kind of seem to stop. Can you talk to us about the larger process then of taking a drug to market beyond the trials and beyond the FDA approval?
After FDA approves a medication with full approval, then usually the sponsor or the company that has come up with the drug will determine a price tag for that medication. Then Medicare or CMS and other insurance companies will determine how much they are willing to cover in terms of the cost of the drug itself. And they may negotiate with the company producing the drug in terms of the price tag to some extent. And eventually, the payers will decide how quickly and how much they will cover. And depending on the type of drug, pill versus injections versus infusions, it may take a little bit of time for it to then get to the market for clinicians in practice then to get used to using the drug, being able to get the drug authorized. So there is this period of transition where clinicians may feel that there is evidence to use the drug, but payers have not made that shift yet. And so that is usually a process that may last several months or several years.
Several months or several years. That is such a long transition period for people living with dementia and their care partners to even understand or wrap their heads around. Can you share with us a little more just about why is this process so long?
Yeah, so for example, the process can be really long for many factors. Some of it, like I mentioned, are payer related and a little bit of related to the efficacy of the drug, what the trial data shows, seeping in of the drug's usage from, you know, very specialized centers that do clinical trials to other specialists to then primary care and so forth, depending on the type of drug. And then some of it is related to how the drug is administered and what kind of infrastructure is required to then provide access to that drug in a equitable manner throughout the country. And then again, that's often driven by the data that the drug shows, how many other drugs are available in the system, right? So we all like familiarity and comfort. So if we are used to using a drug that works well, that doesn't have too many side effects, then it's harder to make that switch to a newer drug. Whereas if there is nothing in that realm, then our ability to go to the new drug is increased and heightened in that manner. So it can be a very long process for patients. And I understand that's really, really frustrating, but sometimes it is so systemically driven, I should say, that their individual physicians may not actually have any control over how quickly they can get access. So for example, let's start with aducanumab. The way aducanumab was approved was that it was called an accelerated approval. So it wasn't a full traditional approval. Accelerated approval can be used in cases of drugs where FDA thinks that the mechanism of action is robust and gives some evidence that there may be beneficial effects downstream. And so they get an accelerated approval. But the drug was so surrounded by controversy that CMS eventually decided that they were not going to pay for it. And therefore, it really didn't gain a lot of traction with payers, even patients and clinicians. Whereas lecanemab's clinical trials have been much more clear, less surrounded by controversy, and have clear statistical benefits that come across as more convincing to clinicians. Therefore, it has also gotten full traditional approval, which has then led for CMS to say, we will pay for this drug. But even then, the system has to adapt to it. It is, for example, depending on the type of monoclonal antibody for an amyloid that we are looking at, it can be an infusion, which lecanemab is. It is given twice a month. So every 2 weeks, you have to get an infusion. And it has several monitoring requirements, which we can get into in a little bit. But essentially, to be able to give people twice a week, every 2 weeks infusion, need to have infusion centers that are ready or to administer that drug. That drug needs to not just be available in the pharmacy. It's not a pill I can write a prescription for. So those kinds of systemic changes need to happen. You need to have specialized nurses who can monitor these infusion centers. So I can't just say to it that, oh, we're just going to give you the infusion in my clinic tomorrow. There has to be designated infusion center, nurses that can watch people for infusion reactions. We have to be able to send them for MRIs on a routine basis and a monitoring basis so that if something goes wrong, we can look at their brain MRI. So we have to have a group of neuroradiologists that are involved. We also have to have a team at our center, at our clinic, that's monitoring and tracking every patient and that where they are in their infusions and what their needs are based on where they are in their infusions. So it is something that requires a lot of manpower, a lot of systemic changes, and requires a lot of thinking through, which our systems are not ready for. And it will also have to be adapted based on where you are. So for example, we're in the Phoenix metropolitan area, and you know, we have multiple subspecialty centers, we have big hospitals, urgent care centers, neuroradiologists, all kinds of people that can help us do these things. That is probably not true for northern rural Arizona, and definitely not true for many other centers. So we also have to think about what kind of system will actually work for where we are situated.
You really help to bring to light just how complicated this process is to bring this drug to market. I mean, you're talking things like systemic change. It makes so much sense now that it's not just approve and have access to the medication. But something that you said caught my attention. You mentioned really considering how these medications can be distributed in an equitable manner. Can you explain a little bit more what you mean by that, and what kind of considerations go into making sure that access is equitable?
Equity is a major challenge in our healthcare systems, but are also challenging at the level of individual people. So we have to have two different ways of which we think about this. One is in a systemic manner, right? So geographical areas where we live impact our access to specialists and subspecialists. And a drug that has many high risk side effects that need close monitoring in a subspecialty setting is inherently less accessible to people who are not near these subspecialists. On top of that, these drugs require intense MRI monitoring with very specialized scans, which these kinds of MRI scanners may not be available outside of big cities. And so that's another challenge. You also need specialized people who have expertise in reading these scans. And again, that may not be available in all geographical areas. So that's a geographical situation. Second, remember these drugs are only approved for people in very early stages of the disease. So mild cognitive impairment and mild dementia. People in moderate to severe stages of the disease will not benefit from this drug, which is what, you know, news outlets don't tell you. But to be able to help people in the mild stages of the disease, we have to diagnose them in milder stages of the disease, meaning that our whole diagnostic paradigm has to shift into diagnosing dementia early. And that, again, is a challenge in areas where specialty clinics are not available. So again, that in itself creates another barrier for people. And then we know about barriers that underrepresented communities face. So we know that underrepresented communities are less likely to seek medical attention, less likely to recognize dementia as a medical condition that requires treatment, and are less likely to be taken seriously when they present with concerns to their physicians and healthcare practitioners. So those inherent barriers continue to act against them and will be exacerbated in the context of a systemic change like this. To top it all off, we have struggled with this throughout medicine and Alzheimer's disease clinical trials, which is the number of people in the underrepresented minority ethnic groups that are able to participate in the trials are much, much lower, right? So all of these trials have more than 90% of people who are white, Caucasian, educated folks, and the people who are in the lower socioeconomic strata, not as educated, underrepresented different ethnicities are so much lower that in being able to translate the data that we have to how this might affect them and given their background is limited, but we still want to be able to offer a drug to them that is available. So we have to constantly balance and give them this nuanced understanding of where we are in terms of the efficacy of the drug. So all of these systemic barriers will play against them. And finally, all people, all healthcare practitioners that are giving out, that are prescribing this drug need to be aware of their own cognitive biases. And we all have cognitive biases when we walk into the room, right? They're nice people, they wanna be helped, I wanna help them. Or, you know, I feel like they're kind of high maintenance, maybe I don't want to give them a drug that's already high maintenance. So these are cognitive biases I have, right? Maybe I miss breakfast and it's lunchtime and everyone's asking a lot of questions. Or, you know, maybe they are really, really interested in this drug and their interest drives my interest. So all of these things together affect our decision making, and we have to be aware of it and really try and break it down for our patients. What I see as my responsibility is to break down the data for the drug in simpler terms for my patients. Believe that your patients understand nuance. Tell them about the nuance. They can make decisions about themselves and their loved ones when you give them the nuance. And so my job is really to present the data to them in as much unbiased manner as possible and help them make that decision. And finally, to be upfront about what we do not know about the medications yet. So I think it's really important to be honest with our patients, and they are able to make those decisions at that time.
Thank you for sharing this in-depth information about this complex transition and barriers in equitable access and breaking it down for our patients. So if someone came into you, what would this mean for them? What does it mean for our patients and caregivers? What should they know? When should they go and ask their doctor about this and find out who qualifies and is it covered by their insurance and should they be getting access to it?
Yes, absolutely. So very good question. And no one size will fit all. But in general, I'm going to say this. The first thing they need to do is to have an accurate diagnosis of their loved one. So it always starts there and starts with the primary care physician. And hopefully we'll have more and more tools for our primary care physicians to be able to diagnose them. The second thing that they need to have is appropriate staging. They really need to work with their doctors about where they are in their disease journey. And like I said, this medication is not for everyone, and it's not a cure. It will not reverse symptoms. So it is really a very small window where people are eligible for this drug. So at the very least, people will get the diagnosis early, understand where they are in their disease process early. And that brings with it a lot of benefits that we talked about in our previous episode. After that point, if they're eligible for the drug, they will have to work with their doctors in probably getting invasive testing like CSF to make sure that they have amyloid in the brain, because if you're trying to remove amyloid from the brain with a drug, you must show that there is amyloid in the brain. And then they may have to have certain MRIs. And then there are criteria that their doctors need to look at for their MRI, at their MRIs, to make sure that they truly qualify or their risk of bleeding is not too high. Some people will require genetic testing. So there's a lot of prep work. And after they have all of these initial testing, the doctors can sit down with them and have a proper nuanced discussion about what their risk might be. And then it is a matter of them being able to understand the balance of their benefit and risk and make a decision about whether this is a drug that truly benefits them.
Throughout our conversation today, you have brought up some really interesting considerations that go along with these treatment medications, things like diagnosis and access to care. Can you talk to us briefly about what you see on the horizon for Alzheimer's and other dementia treatments?
Yes. Regardless of how much risk is associated with these drugs, we have to be very, very careful. Safety is always first for our patients, because I always tell people my first oath is do no harm. We have to be very safe about bringing this drug to our patients. And then, you know, like I said, this drug is not for everyone. It is for a select few, but that doesn't mean there is nothing for others. So we have to come up with drugs that not only attack amyloid. Alzheimer's is a very complex process, involves other things like tau, which is another protein that can be seen. It also involves inflammation. It also involves changes in metabolic factors. And so we have drugs in the pipeline through our clinical trials that are trying to assess various different aspects of this mechanism and trying to target them. So we have drugs that are trying to change glucose metabolism. We're trying to change the different types of receptors in tau. So we're trying to use genetic changes, so that we have a lot of different clinical trials that are ongoing. And we need people in those trials, because not everyone's going to want an infusion every 2 weeks. We need oral drugs. We need injectables like insulin that people can give on their own. So we need a variety of drugs that target different pathways. And then maybe we'll be able to combine drugs to then make meaningful changes in people's lives. And that's just disease-modifying therapies. We still need symptomatic treatments, right? So until we're able to stop and cure the disease, we still need to help people with their symptoms, whether that's agitation, whether that's apathy, whether that's being able to participate in activities. So symptomatic treatment trials are also available. And then we also need to have something for people who are in advanced stages of the disease. We need to better our diagnosis. So we have some tau scans, we need better tau scans. And to be able to do that, we need people who are maybe at the very end of life and be able to look at their pathology. So people shouldn't feel like they've missed the boat if they aren't able to be eligible for this drug. There are still things they can do that help them and also leave a legacy behind for their children and grandchildren.
Dr. Chowdhury, you've given us such a broad picture of, I think, a simple question that we started out with, which was, now what, now that these medications have been approved? Some of these conversations, I feel like we just almost get like a peek behind the curtain into a world that we didn't really understand. So I'm really grateful for today's conversation. And before we close, could you give us your final thought when it comes to these new medications?
Yeah, so I think the way I feel about these medications are that this is an exciting time for us in Alzheimer's disease treatment. We're shifting paradigms. At the very least, this will shift the rapidity with which we want to diagnose people. I hope that these drugs finally bring some urgency to diagnosis. The second thing that these drugs will do is help us include biomarkers in our day-to-day assessment, disease assessment. So things like MRIs, PET scans, and then blood biomarkers that we talked about in our previous episode. All of those things will start to be incorporated much more, giving people higher accuracy of diagnosis. And then finally, with these drugs now here, like I said, it is not for everybody, but the future holds that there will be something for everybody. And we're trying to work on that. We do need people to participate. We need people of various different ethnic backgrounds to participate. I want to be able to tell my African-American patient exactly how this new drug will affect them, because their brain may be different than the Caucasian person that was in the clinical trial. So we really need those people to come forward and help us move the treatment and the disease and the field forward. And, you know, safety will always be first. So whether you are in clinic or in clinical trials, our responsibility to keep you safe is the most important.
Today, our conversation has been with Dr. Parikshita Chowdhury, a cognitive neurologist at Banner Sun Health Research Institute. We appreciate you helping us untangle these new drugs.
Very happy to be involved.
Thank you so much, Dr. Chowdhury. I just can't thank you enough for breaking it down in such an easy to understand way. You are absolutely amazing. Thank you for coming back and being on the podcast. And thank you, Heather, for another wonderful conversation. And I just want to take a moment to tell our listeners how grateful we are to all of you. Thank you for joining us. If you haven't already, please subscribe and share this podcast. I'm looking forward to our next conversation on Dementia Untangled. Thank you for joining us for this episode of Dementia Untangled. Be sure to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
Dementia Untangled is hosted by Heather Mulder and Janice Greeno, produced and edited by Amber Ayers, and is brought to you by Banner Alzheimer's Institute and Banner Sun Health Research Institute. We are supported by generous donations to the Banner Alzheimer's Foundation.
Please visit our website at bannerhealth.com/Alzheimer's and follow us on Facebook to learn about upcoming events. If you have questions or comments, please email us at dementiauntangled@bannerhealth.com.